Ave,
and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Dr. Rhiannon Evans, Senior Lecturer in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University. This is Episode CII, Clodia. The women of Rome are largely missing from the written records, and often only come up tangentially in works by or about the men in their lives. They're frequently painted as villains, temptresses, and poisoners. Clodia is no exception. So join us as we try and unpack the woman behind the myth. Here's Rhiannon Evans.
Clodia comes from an incredibly elite Roman family. She comes from the Clodii. They are very aristocratic. They've had many consuls in their background. So she is kind of set up to be well married, to be an important part of Roman society in as much women can. Mm. She's very well connected. Her father is Appius Claudius Pulcher. He spells his name A-U. At some point, she and her brother, Clodius, change the A-U to an O.
Okay.
So don't get confused about that. They are the same family, the Claudii and the Clodii.
All right. I'm sure we'll get into that. What era are we talking about of Roman history?
It's the late Republic. She is prominent in the early and mid first century BCE.
Mm. And just a bit of context, what role did women have in the society then? Are they mostly, I don't want to say to be seen and not heard, but useful as a marrying kind of alliance thing to Roman elite families?
If you're an elite woman, that's certainly one of the roles that you play, that you can connect elite families, you can help to formulate alliances.
Mm-hmm.
There is more than that. And I think that while Rome was a very patriarchal society, literally the father had an incredible amount of sway. Women could own property. They were often important within their household in terms of the education of their children and the economic independence within the household. And they were also capable of, as Clodia did, carrying out business deals, selling, buying property,
yep,
owning slaves, of course, which were property. So it's not quite as restrictive a life as you might think. And indeed, some would say that women during the Republic, elite women, have a lot more power than they do once we get to the imperial period. So this might be the last great time for women in ancient Rome.
Now, sorry to drag this back to her father then, but in the context of the family, where did their allegiances fall?
In terms of the power struggles of the late Republic, her father is aligned with probably the more conservative element. And certainly he marries her to a man who is very much from what we call the optimates,
mm-hmm,
so the more senatorial conservative element. And her husband is called Quintus Caecilius Metellus. So she's sometimes called Clodia Metelli,
mm-hmm,
which literally means Clodia of Metellus, which sounds like something from The Handmaid's Tale now I say it out loud. Because their names are of somebody,
mm-hmm,
aren't they? This is a great alliance because her father, he's a consul in 78 BCE, and Metellus is her cousin, and he's also from a consular family. So a very renowned family too, and strong connections between them. In terms of politics as well, Clodia and certainly her brother Clodius seem to drift more towards the other side of politics. So in opposition to her husband, to perhaps the more populares side, although we should be careful about saying that because Clodius in particular seems to go where he can get power. We think of him as being in allegiance, particularly with Julius Caesar, but some people think that was convenient for him at the time and he's acting more for himself.
Okay. But at any rate, Clodia, at odds with her husband, you say, was that an active thing or is that just a modern interpretation of what she believed?
We don't get much access to what she believed. It's very indirect and it's really interpreted by ancient historians and particularly sources like Cicero. And the main source we have from Cicero is quite hostile to her.
Yeah.
And also, as we'll see in our main source, which is a murder trial, Cicero is trying to paint her in a particular way. And one of the ways is that he can't say it outright, but that she might have been responsible for her husband's death.
Okay.
So that's kind of playing up the conflict between them, I guess.
Okay. So why the name change then for both her and her brother?
It seems to be to align themselves more with that popular party because the pronunciation of the AU is AU. In the more ordinary accent of the time is often pronounced as O. So it sounds like Claudius, even though it's spelt A-U. So people start to spell it like that, which is what happens.
That's so they essentially change. Americanized the spelling of their name. Is that
Sort of, it's very hard to draw modern
I'll take that
parallels.
S and make it a Z, and I'll drop a couple of letters so it's actually spelt how it's pronounced.
You've got to be very careful. A lot of those are actually original that Britain changed. It's hard to make those modern parallels because I was going to go for a class parallel in that it's a working class accent, but that doesn't really work either. It's how probably spoken Latin was going.
Yeah.
If you're literate, which is the minority of people, then you know how it's spelt and you might read it how it's spelt.
Mm.
But if you're going by the way that it comes off on the common tongue, then it comes as an O. So I guess she's aligning herself. She and her brother are aligning themselves more with the populares, with the ordinary people, by changing the spelling of their name. It's kind of making a point to distance themselves from that elite background.
Yeah.
Which at the same time they will play on when they need to, of course.
That's really interesting then that she changes the spelling of her name as well. So Clodia's husband, Metallus, dies under slightly suspicious circumstances, which are not addressed at the time in 59 BCE at the youngish age of 44. So at this point, you would expect a young lady of her standing to be quickly married again, or at least a eligible. I don't know if she's young. I don't know.
Well, she's born in, say, 94.
Mm.
So she's, what, 35?
Okay. So look, young enough to be eligible. I'm not going to cast a stone here. Why isn't this direction taken?
Presumably, she has a lot of control over her own life at this point. This can happen when a woman is widowed. This is really one of the better positions that women can be in the ancient world and in ancient Rome, is to be widowed and to be what we call liberated. So they've been set free from a father or a husband's power.
Yeah.
If her father had wanted her to form another alliance, he, I guess, might still have had that authority, but she seems to have been able to act under her own authority after that.
Yeah.
And that, in a way, is one of the problems that our ancient sources have with her, is that she is a woman who can do what she likes and apparently did do what she wanted. That makes her a dangerous proposition for the more conservative elements.
Mm. Okay, well, let's wade into that. Our main ancient source when you're talking about Clodia is Cicero. And why does Cicero write about her?
It's in a very indirect way. Cicero is acting in the defense of a man called Caelius in a murder trial. And we have the speech, the pro Caelio, but we don't have all of it. And sometimes the circumstances aren't clear. Cicero's strategy in this case, what you really need to know, is to say everything Caelius has done wrong that you can sort of blacken his character with is down to the fact that he was young and he was under the influence of this woman, Clodia.
Right.
So he may have cast his wild oats around and behaved in a slightly drunken and dissolute way, but it's just because he was in love with Clodia. And now he's over that. Don't see him badly because of that. And so he spends a lot of time blackening the character of Clodia, and really suggesting that she is the dissolute one. She's kind of permanently dissolute as opposed to Caelius, who was just under her spell.
Okay.
He says that she sleeps around. She's an adulteress. She goes off to Baiae, which is sort of the, I don't know, the Monte Carlo of the ancient world. It's where the rich go to party. It's by this time, especially with people like Cicero, associated with that kind of reprehensible behavior of the rich, people who are not taking responsibility. He's on the Bay of Naples, very beautiful holidaying zone. And he spends a lot of time talking about how she goes there and she takes lovers and they drink and, you know, live in this debauched lifestyle that they have. So he tries to paint her in this way. And as part of that, he suggests that one of the slurs he makes against her is that she may have poisoned her husband. And that's why he died young. So she was trying to get rid of him so that she could live this party lifestyle. Which is not surprising, as many scholars have pointed out. There's this strong alliance in the Roman mind in particular between women who poison and women who commit adultery. They're often seen together, and that happens in mythology too. The one you can't trust not to pollute your food is also polluting your family. All right, so there's a kind of pollution element. It's not surprising that the association is made for Clodia. But this is our main source on Clodia. It's in very, very heightened and particular circumstances where Cicero, you know, he'll basically say anything he can to get his client off. And by the way, it worked. This was a successful defense. So dragging her reputation through the mud is something that is successful with the jury in this case. And Caelius gets off the murder charge.
Mm. The murder charge for Caelius was the poisoning of the Egyptian ambassador. Mm. So you've got the poison element come through there. But Clodia wasn't implicated in that at all, was she? That, you know, she poisoned her ex-husband. Clearly she poisoned the Egyptian ambassador as well.
No, the reason Clodia is involved at all is that she accuses Caelius of various things, and she seems to be a witness who can pinpoint that he might have had access to, yeah, that might have been part of this conspiracy, really. And that she can also say that he behaved in certain ways around her, which were not appropriate, which were violent or, you know, angry or outrageous. So part of Cicero's job is to discredit her word.
Mm.
So if he can make her look like an unreliable person, and basically saying that she hasn't got an upright character is doing that. I have to say, this is something that we might think we're immune to, but it is seen in courts. You know, if you can say that someone's character isn't reliable, then that might discredit their evidence.
Discredits them as a witness, yeah.
Yeah. But to bring it down to her personal behavior, we might question these days, but for Cicero, it absolutely works.
Mm-hmm. Is there a couple of choice Cicero quotes that you want to pull out there that are good?
Cicero has this pretense of being coy about it, of just talking generally about the way that women behave. He says, here, I'll just outline the situation itself. I'll mention no woman by name, just so much I'll leave ambiguous. If some unmarried woman throws open her house to the lust of all men and openly establishes herself in a whorish lifestyle, if she makes a habit of enjoying dinner parties with men who are complete strangers, if she were to do this in the city, in the park, among the crowds at Baiae, if finally not only in her bearing but also her dress and the company she keeps, not only by flaming eyes and licentious speech but also by embraces, lascivious kissing, beach parties, boating parties, dinner parties, she were to conduct herself in such a way that she was seen to be not only a whore, but a brazen and dissipated whore. If by chance some young man should have been with this woman, would he appear in your eyes to be a predator or a lover, to have wanted to conquer her chastity or to satisfy her lust? So it's not Caelius's fault. This woman was just laying herself open to it.
If there were such a woman, a hypothetical woman, yeah, not that I'm looking at everybody, hi, Clodia, would she have been there during this thing, or this is all happening in her absence?
A lot of the evidence gets provided in writing. You don't have to appear as a witness to talk.
Okay.
So probably not.
It's just caged in such a way then where he's not saying names. He's not naming Clodia at all. But if there should be such a woman who, well, everybody knows her reputation.
Yeah, and look, it really has dominated discourse about Clodia, so that when you get to someone like Plutarch, who's writing over 100 years later, this is in the life of someone called Lucullus, he says, he's talking about Clodius. Publius Clodius was a man of wanton violence. He was the brother of a woman of the most dissolute ways, whom he was actually accused of debauching. So she's described as a woman of the most dissolute ways, and quite an offhand statement by Plutarch. But
yeah,
that's based clearly on him reading Cicero and believing Cicero.
Yeah, okay.
Cicero also appeals to the difference between the way he represents Clodia's behavior and the way she should act because she comes from such a renowned family. So he plays this game where he pretends that the ghost of one of Clodia's ancestors has come back and is talking to her and kind of shaming her when he appears in front of her. And it's the great Appius Claudius from the past, who was a great war hero. And he says, in truth, if he can come forth from the dead, he will deal thus with her. He will say, woman, what have you to do with Caelius? What have you to do with a very young man? What have you to do with one who does not belong to you? Why have you been so intimate with him as to lend him gold? And that is part of Cicero's case, that Clodia says that, you know, she's helped Caelius, both lent him money, and that she knows that he has poison, so she's therefore scared of him now because he has access to poison. And Cicero kind of uses this against her to say, how can you have been close enough to Caelius to know these things and to be lending him money.
Mm.
This actually is not something that speaks against Caelius for Cicero. It's something that speaks against Clodia, that she allowed him to be intimate enough to know these things about him. So he kind of undermines her evidence by saying, you shouldn't even be in this position.
And by putting it in the mouth of an ancestor, you're saying that authority and...
And a renowned ancestor. So he gets the kind of double whammy of this man is somebody that she should be living up to and she's not, but also he can come back and berate her. So there's this greater weight of authority even than Cicero standing up and saying it.
He also implicates that she had an affair with her brother.
He says, to quote, and this is from the same speech, I had not a quarrel with that woman's husband. Brother, I meant to say, I'm always making this mistake.
And it sounds like he's playing that for laughs.
Absolutely, yeah. Yes. And Cicero often does this. He's the master of rhetoric. This idea that he's tripped over what he says, but he said it very deliberately,
of course, making the
mistake. What we would call a Freudian slip of calling Clodius her husband. So implying that she has poisoned her actual husband and that she's committed incest with her brother. And presumably this would be enhanced by the fact that she's sided with him in his political endeavours.
Mm.
As opposed to siding with her husband, who she owes her allegiance to in Roman terms, that would strengthen these accusations and the fact that they're both depicted as these debauched characters.
Yeah, so no problem dragging the brother's name through the dirt as well in this.
Oh, Cicero really hates Clodius.
Okay, so no problem at
all. This is something we should comment on, actually, that this is taking place in 56 BCE.
Mm.
2 years before this, Cicero had been briefly exiled.
Yeah,
Clodius was the tribune of the plebs at the time, and he's the one who had brought through the laws that basically forced Cicero into exile.
So this is even more of a personal stake for him.
Absolutely.
Okay.
He loathes Clodius more than anybody in the world, I think.
All right, so we've got one very biased kind of view on who Clodia was and what she did with her life and how she conducted herself. But how accurate is that? What else can we know about her from the contemporary sources?
So there is a theory that a lot of classicists hold that she is also the person in a lot of the poems of Catullus, a late Republican poet, whom he refers to as Lesbia. These seem to be very deeply personal poems where he talks about a love affair where he's completely bowled over with somebody who in the end betrays him as he sees it and sleeps with other men and breaks his heart. And there are a lot of poems that are showing him deeply hurt and also real invective about how much he now loathes her and needs to break off from her.
That being Lesbia.
Yes, she's called Lesbia in these poems. He doesn't use the name Clodia. There are some clues that it might be her. For example, he talks about a character called Pulcher, and this character is called Lesbius. And so Lesbius, which is the male form of Lesbia, is Pulcher.
Insinuates the brother.
Yeah, insinuates Clodius Pulcher.
Oh, right.
And, yeah, and she could be known as Clodia Pulchra. So that may be a reference to these two being aligned and being the same person.
Do you have a couple of choice Catullus passages there?
Yeah, it comes over as a real love-hate relationship. There aren't very many happy poems. There are a few where Catullus seems entirely enraptured. And I should say, even before I read any, we often read it as autobiographical, but it's poetry.
Okay,
you know, it might have all been invented. However, it's very hard not to. And sometimes, you know, he uses the first person a lot, and sometimes he uses the name Catullus in these poems. Anyway, let me read you one where he does seem entirely in love and it is briefly going well.
Is this an early poem?
Well, we don't know
what
order he wrote them in. It is poem 5, but I have to say the order is imposed later, so we don't know. This is a famous one. We should live, my Lesbia, and love and value all the talk of stricter old men at a single penny. Suns may set and rise again when our brief light has set once. We must sleep an eternal night. Give me 1,000 kisses, then 100, then another 1,000, then a second 100, then another 1,000, then 100. Then when we have counted up many thousands, let us shake it up, lest we know, or lest anyone bad may be jealous, when they know how many kisses there were.
Yeah, that's early in the relationship. That sounds exhausting, sorry.
Yeah. Look, in terms of early, it looks like an early in the relationship poem. Absolutely. This poem appeals to a lot of classicists who think he's talking about those senatorial conservative types in these stricter old men who might tut at all the kissing.
That's what I took from it.
Yeah. And, you know, that basically he means people like Cicero.
All right, so that's when things were going well with Lesbia, and we've got a few poems where it clearly has changed.
So poem 83, Catullus implies that Lesbia is sort of winking behind her husband's back, or they're having an affair while her husband's still around.
Yeah.
So she's pretending in front of him. Lesbia hurls abuses at me in her husband's presence. This is the summit of happiness for that dolt. You ass, don't you get it? If she keeps quiet, oblivious of me, she would be cured of her passion. But now, since she snarls and curses, not only does she remember, but something fiercer by far. She's furious. That is, she burns, and so she has to speak. That's poem 83. And that implies that it's a very tempestuous relationship. The cut and thrust of it implies passion.
It also implies that possibly Metallus knew about it.
That he might have suspected, yes. Mm. If you follow this narrative, it all goes horribly wrong, and Catullus ends up bemoaning and attacking Lesbia in these poems and really going for it. So poem 11 starts with Catullus talking to his friends about them going all around the world, and he says to them, wherever you are, say a few words to Lesbia for me. Give a message to my girl. These words few and not pretty. Let her live and farewell with her perverts, whom she clasps 300 at a time, loving none truly, but grinding the groins of all of them over and over.
Oh, dude.
Yeah.
So between that being poem 11 and the other one, which was 1,000 kisses for you is never enough, being poem 5.
Yeah, they're not in order in the Catullan corpus. They're all over the place.
Oh, I like to think that they are. Yeah.
There are poems where he says, oh, poor Catullus, you have to forget about Lesbia. Oh, but I can't. Oh, the ones that are much more the pathetic stage.
Yeah.
And there's also the really angry stage.
So if Lesbia is Clodia, then that would kind of corroborate what Cicero is saying about her sleeping around and...
Yeah, and some people who make that alignment absolute think that she leaves Catullus for Caelius. So that's where she moves on to.
Okay.
If you want to build a chronology like that, you can. However, it's not on completely certain ground. I mean, I would agree that the whole Lesbius is Pulcher is quite persuasive. But the real reason that people make this analogy exact is what we're told by a much later writer, a man called Apuleius, who was writing in the second century CE. He's a North African Latin writer.
Yep.
And this is actually from a defense speech of his. He's defending himself against an accusation of witchcraft.
Okay.
As part of that narrative, he talks about pseudonyms. Pseudonyms are used in literature. He says there's nothing sinister about that. You can't accuse me because I might have done this. And in Apology chapter 10, he says, this is what they throw at my teeth, as though it were the work of an infamous rake, verses about garlands and serenades. You must have noticed also in this connection, they further attack me for calling these boys Carinus and Critias. So he's used pseudonyms for his boy loves in his writings. On this principle, they might as well accuse Catullus for calling Clodia Lesbia. Mm. And then he gives a list of other poets who've done something similar.
Okay.
And in every case, the pseudonym has the same metrical form as the real name. So the idea is that those who know who this really is can just change Lesbia to Clodia and it'll still work as a poem.
So this is vaguely 250 years later.
Yeah.
So by then it's either common knowledge or common misinterpretation.
One of the issues is there was more than one Clodia sister as well, we should mention. So Clodius has more than one sister. And by Roman naming convention, they're both called Clodia.
I'm just going to throw my iPad at this point.
Yeah, this is how some of my students feel about Roman names and some other things in Latin too. And of course, the other one we know even less about. So it's possible that it's the other sister. It's possible that Catullus had a very active imagination.
So where does general classics weigh in on it? Is there more Lesbia as Clodia? Where does Marilyn Skinner weigh in on it?
Marilyn Skinner sees it as circumstantial, and she's worried about making this absolute coincidence match. And I think she's quite right. The problem she really has, though, and it's the problem I share with her, is the just mapping Cicero onto the poems of Catullus and churning out this aberrant, dissolute woman and just believing that as fact. So I think it's more the problem is that we've just decided these male sources, at least one of them, a very conservative man with a real axe to grind, have been seen as the kind of voice of the oracle on Clodia. You can do this interesting test with this. It's a bit like the one I did on Cleopatra when we did the live event,
where
I read from the Oxford Classical Dictionary, the version from the 1940s on Cleopatra, and then the more recent one. And the tone in the 1940s one, and you can bet it would be the same for Clodia, is very judgmental. Whereas more recently, we kind of want to see her more neutrally. I mean, she may have had affairs, but she's also clearly a woman who was acting under her own aegis, her own authority. Because we can pick up little hints from elsewhere, and Marilyn Skinner is good at pointing these out in letters of Cicero, that he had business dealings with her.
Yeah.
Right? That she was helpful to him in the selling of some property. We have to really read into Cicero, I think. There's this real division in how he uses Clodia in his court case.
He's got an agenda.
He's quite happy when it's to his advantage in his business to work with her as a fellow business person.
Yeah, despite the fact that her brother really did a number on him.
Yes, indeed. I don't think he'd ever do that with Clodius. So we have to see her as somebody who was lucky enough and rich enough to be able to have this independent lifestyle. And we shouldn't really reduce her to what we find particularly in the Cicero speech, which you're absolutely right, has such an axe to grind.
Mm.
I think you would align that much more to a version of someone you might get from the tabloid press, which is not to say that Cicero isn't a great writer, but he knows how to work on people's emotions and their expectations for how women should behave. And he really uses Clodia. He does a number on her, but he gets his client off. So I guess he would argue that the greater cause is served here. But we can't just read that as a neutral version of Clodia.
Of course not, no. So how do you go about rehabilitating her then in the modern scholarship?
Well, it's difficult because of the sources and the nature of them, but I think you have to do what Marilyn Skinner does.
Sorry, give her a proper book plug. Marilyn Skinner.
She doesn't need my book plugs, but I will anyway.
Author of.
So Marilyn Skinner has a great book on this called Clodia Metelli, The Tribune's Sister.
Hmm.
I shouldn't speak for her, but I think that the subtitle there is an attempt to see her as more than Metellus's wife and more than Catullus's bit on the side and more than this woman who's demonized by Cicero, that she also has this political worth. She has this political strength in that she can be aligned with Clodius too. Now, of course, women can't have direct access to political power in the Roman Republic, but they can have influence. Mm. And calling her the tribune's sister shows that she might well have had quite a lot of influence in those dealings. I mean, the 50s is a really turbulent time in Roman politics. And that she might well have been part of that. So she's a businesswoman. She might well be a political manipulator. She's somebody who you can't reduce to just this woman who slept around a lot.
Yeah. And it's a little troubling that this is probably the most that we know of a Roman woman from that era. And it's a slanderous speech and implied poetry.
Yeah, look, it's part of the problem that we don't get biographies of women.
Full stop.
Yeah. So again, with Cleopatra, you know, when we look at her, it's through the biographies of Caesar and Mark Antony.
Mark Antony, yes.
And another part of that problem is that a lot of our evidence is quite hostile. So you'd have the same problem when we looked at the Emperor Livia, where our ancient historians see her as a nasty stepmother plotting to get rid of people.
And same difference with Agrippina.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we've seen it in quite a few women along the line, haven't we? And I guess what we should do one day is we should look at a woman for, unfortunately, we'll have less evidence. But, you know, there are women that we have evidence of them being involved in say, business or local government. And they've got a statue in Pompeii or something like that.
Oh, Eumechia.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know who I'm talking about. Well done. She'd be a great character to talk about one day as not only not from the traditional Roman elite,
yes,
but also somebody who seems to have had a much less troubling reputation, that there was no reason to demonize her.
Mm.
So while we have less written evidence, it would still be nice to look at a woman who's represented differently, I think. One thing we can say about Clodia is that she made a name for herself. She is a woman that we know about, and we know her by name. And we know that she continued to act even after this court case, that she had a life conducted in business and an independent life. We do get at least a kind of vibrant portrait, however negative and unreliable it might be. We can see that she was an important figure in the late Republic. We can see that she was acting in public and what the potential was for somebody who had kind of more liberated lifestyle than many at the time did. Cicero, clearly, he hadn't written Clodia off, and she also hadn't written him off, because we know from his letters that there are still business dealings between them after the court case, and that she was a friend of Cicero's friend Atticus. So they had that connection. So Clodia continues to act in public life after this, and she's not cut off even from people who've demonized her.
That's Dr. Rhiannon Evans, Senior Lecturer in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe in Apple Podcasts or your local friendly neighborhood podcatching service. Please leave a review. Mexico, New Zealand, I'm looking at you. I know you're listening. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow myself and Rhiannon Evans on Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans, and I am at Nightlight Guy. In the next episode of Emperors of Rome, we take a look at old age in the Roman Empire. So until then, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.